Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media. Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Ignorance is not bliss. Some potentially life-threatening health conditions can creep up on you. There may be no symptoms to warn you. Dr. Christine Horner, MD, speaks to parents and adults on five silent killers: high blood pressure, HPV, pancreatic cancer, diabetes, and sleep apnea. So get the 411 this hour on 411 Teen with Dr. Horner, an award-winning author and leading expert in natural health. Dr. Horner, welcome to 411 Teen.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Oh, I really appreciate it. So early detection affords one an opportunity to address, I guess, potentially threatening conditions. Let's look at some of these conditions. How about we start with diabetes? Diabetes seems to be, unfortunately, very prevalent. And I guess it affects your body. It affects how your body uses blood sugar, correct?
Yeah. And in fact, everything that we're going to talk about today are conditions where you don't have any symptoms even when you start out. That's true for diabetes, too. But, yeah, so all of these, you know, as it turns out, a lot of people don't want to go to the doctor because, you know, they feel fine or, you know, I don't think anything's going on with them, so they don't go in for their, you know, annual visits. Mm-hmm. And there's actually quite a number of different diseases that you could get that are, you know, working on you and wouldn't even know it because, you know, these things don't have any symptoms. And the reason that we're talking about all these things today is because they're actually preventable and reversible. So I don't like to come on and scare people and tell you bad news about things. It's really all about that these things are very much linked to diet and lifestyle, and they're preventable and reversible.
And when I was just going to say, and when you say lifestyle, as I think about the conditions or the diseases you have identified, some of them can be addressed, and you tell me if I'm incorrect, if one maintains a well visit, you know, just a regular checkup, because I think, well, we haven't gotten to it, but high blood pressure. I mean, whenever you go to the doctor, they're going to check you, you know, for your blood pressure. But if you don't go on a regular basis, then it's something that you don't know anything about.
You know, that's absolutely true. So
okay.
Why don't we just go ahead and start with high blood pressure? But, you know, it's so high blood pressure, for instance, is so unbelievably common. Like, it's way more common than most people think of. So the American Heart Association in the past had said anything that's 140 over 90 above that is considered hypertension. Well, last year they changed their guidelines to 130 over 80. And so now the estimate as far as the number of adults in America that have high blood pressure, it's now 50% of adults.
Why did they change it? I mean, I just wonder what was the impetus.
Well, basically what we're looking at with, you know, if you have high blood pressure, the concern with it is that it can increase your risk of developing heart disease, having a heart attack, a stroke, and kidney disease. And so they discovered that the 140 over 90 range is actually, you know, you can start having contributions to heart disease and so forth at a slightly lower blood pressure. So that's why they dropped it to 130 over 80, because even at that, you know, level, there it's not something that's considered normal, and it can increase your risk of, you know, developing those potentially fatal diseases, which, by the way, is the number one killer of Americans. So, you know, it's just super, super common. And, you know, the one thing that we know about heart disease is that pretty much it's all completely preventable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people are following the standard American diet of eating, you know, burgers and fries and processed foods and sugar and, you know, all these mm-hmm. things are not health foods, and they contribute to all sorts of different diseases that definitely increase your risk of cardiovascular disease and hypertension. You know, smoking, drinking too much alcohol, drinking caffeine, not exercising, staying up too late at night, and having a lot of stress in your life. And it's, you know, in this day and age, it's kind of like, well, who doesn't have a lot of stress in
right.
their life, right?
Yes, stress.
So that's, you know, back about 5,000 years ago, there was traditional systems of medicine that are still practiced today. Ayurveda, which is kind of from the area where India is,
right.
and then also traditional Chinese medicine, you know, they recognized 5,000 years ago that stress was a major contributor to, you know, virtually every chronic disease. And so they came up with effective stress-reducing techniques is what we call them in Ayurveda.
Mm-hmm.
Meditation and yoga were the principal ones. In traditional Chinese medicine, they use Tai Chi, Qigong, and most people have seen pictures of all those people out in the courtyards in the morning practicing
right.
these techniques. And,
indeed.
You know, the whole idea of this is that when you practice an effective stress-reducing technique every day, that's the key, like a habit, like brushing your teeth, it trains your nervous system to not be as responsive. So you can have the same stress that comes at you, and your body won't react as strongly, and it won't produce the stress hormones like cortisol, which has lots and lots of serious consequences if it stays chronically elevated. So I personally practice a technique called transcendental meditation.
Mm-hmm.
It was brought to the United States back in the 60s by Maharshi Mahesh Yogi. And it's a simple mental technique. You use a mantra that's just kind of a vehicle to have you get into this kind of place of calm and silence, and it's a very simple technique. There's no effort
right.
that's involved and no
mm-hmm.
trying, you know,
right.
that kind of things. You're trying, you're doing it wrong. But this is the most researched form of meditation. There's been over 500 to 600 studies that have been done on this meditation, and they've actually found that it, for people who practice 20 minutes twice a day is the recommendation, They've discovered through research that it pretty much cuts your risk of most diseases in half.
Mm-hmm.
And with cardiovascular diseases, they found an 87% reduction.
Oh, that's something. But before we go any further, for the listening audience, let's talk a little bit more about how high blood pressure is determined. Because as I understand it, and you correct me, the more blood your heart pumps, the narrower your arteries are, the higher your blood pressure, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's the basic physiology of it, yes.
Yeah, just so. For the listening audience, you know, and
yeah.
we're saying that there are no real symptoms that we can identify. Someone can have high blood pressure, and it sounds like they can have it for years and not be cognizant of it.
Yep, that's absolutely true. And
okay.
until it just gets sky high, then sometimes people will have, you know, symptoms of headaches and dizziness and things like that. But in generally speaking, you don't have any symptoms, which is why people are strongly encouraged to see their doctor at least once a year
mm-hmm.
just as a checkup. And, you know, you can go into drugstores and they've got blood pressure cups
there
where you can
mind.
Check because there's a phenomenon.
God, I was going to ask you about
white
that.
White coat hypertension.
Right.
You know, well, so, when you go in your doctor's office, it's common for your blood pressure to
mm-hmm.
go up. And you can even buy your own blood pressure cuff where you can take your blood
mm-hmm.
pressure at home. And I bought one from Amazon for $20, so they're not very expensive. Yeah.
And are they? What about the efficacy of them? I mean, because I have read
right.
pro and con. Some are saying that, you know, with the blood pressure cuffs, you need to make sure that you should use both arms and you should need to make sure that they're the right size. And so would
mm-hmm.
you just address some of that?
Sure, yeah. So it does make a difference on how you take your blood pressure. And, of course, you got people with really skinny little arms, and you got people with humongous arms. And so there's different size cuffs that are appropriate for each one of those, because if you get one that's too small, it's going to measure your pressure too high. If you get one too big, it's going to measure it too low. So there's a Goldilocks level for each person, and then there's they usually have diagrams on the cuff that show you exactly where you're supposed to line it up with the artery and the we call it the mm-hmm. antecubital fossa, but it's on the other side of your mm-hmm. elbow, basically the crease right there. And so that it has good instructions with it. And if if you're for some reason you have a really humongous arm or a really skinny one, it may not be the most appropriate mm-hmm. thing for you. It might be a little bit more difficult to do that.
Okay. We talked about the risk factors with high blood pressure. I mean, I guess age and race and family, do those play a role? How significant are they with blood pressure problems or hypertension? Yeah. I guess I should use that for the listening audience so they understand that. Hypertension or high blood pressure are all the same.
Yeah, high blood pressure. So, there's certain risk factors that we talked about, such as the diet and smoking and mm-hmm. drinking excessively and not exercising and stress and all that kind of stuff. But there are some racial differences. Black Americans in particular have a tendency to have more hypertension than other races do. Being overweight is definitely a real significant contributor. So because we are now kind of faced with an obesity epidemic, even in children, we're now seeing high blood pressure even in kids. And it used to be that this was a disease that kind of progressively became more common the older you got. But again, the obesity epidemic is something that's really caused this to happen in our children, way too young for that to be occurring.
Mm-hmm. I see. They start at, 3? They will take your blood pressure. I guess they can take it even earlier than that. But usually around 3, you see them taking children's blood pressure 3 and up. Is that correct?
Well, we can even do it on babies.
Right.
Rotated through pediatrics, we did that too. But, it's just, our food supply is not good. It's, really
right.
causing a lot of real problems in mm-hmm. everybody of every age. Yeah.
Okay. And what is the prognosis? I guess if you do all the things that you said and exercise and eat right, then you'll be in good shape.
So this is definitely something that's very reversible.
Mm-hmm.
So cleaning up your diet, starting to exercise, practice a stress-reducing technique, and lose some weight.
Right.
Of this is completely reversible. I said the point of it is we don't have to suffer with these things. We can
right.
prevent them or reverse them. Yeah.
We're going to take a brief break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I've been talking with Dr. Christine Horner. We were talking about high blood pressure, and Dr. Horner, was there anything else that you had wanted to say about high blood pressure before we went on to another condition?
So,
okay.
Covered it pretty well.
All right. How about we go back and we go to diabetes? We said we were going to start there, and then I jumped over to hypertension.
Okay.
As long as that's cool with you, that's fine. What is happening when one has high?
What's happening
when one has diabetes? I mean, I guess your blood sugar, the glucose, the way the body uses it. Is the issue, right?
Well, there's actually a couple different kinds
types.
Of diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so traditionally we would call type 1 diabetes juvenile diabetes and type 2 adult onset diabetes, and they're very different. So, and actually those distinctions that we came up before don't really apply anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And
uh-huh.
it can't have to do with our, obesity epidemic, but so the pancreas is an organ that lays way deep, and our abdomen is kind of against our back, behind the stomach. And it produces hormone called insulin. And insulin is something that helps to facilitate getting glucose into our cells. And so in type 1 diabetes, what happens, we think it's mostly maybe related to some sort of viral infection or autoimmune disease, where it actually destroys some of the cells. They're called beta cells in the pancreas that produce the insulin. And so your body's not producing insulin is the problem. And that causes your blood sugar levels to go very high, and you don't have the insulin available to get that glucose into your cells. Now, type 2 diabetes, which is much more common, it's actually 90% of diabetes in the United States is type 2, and that is basically, again, all diet and lifestyle, where primarily what you're doing is eating too much and too much of the wrong things, you know, particularly refined carbohydrates, processed foods, and sugars, causes your cells to become insulin resistant. So they're not really responding to insulin. So then your pancreas cranks out more and more insulin trying to get the same effect. And in the meantime, because your insulin is not very effective, your blood sugar levels are rising. So in type 1, your insulin levels are low and your blood sugar levels are high. In type 2, your insulin levels are high and your glucose levels are high.
What are the symptoms? What are the symptoms? And I know there
are... Well, you have none.
You have none. You know, but sometimes you hear about increased thirst, that people are more right. thirsty and they start losing weight. So if you could just share those.
Gaining weight, you know, too. So
okay.
that was so some of the symptoms with diabetes is, as you said, there's increased thirst, there's increased urination. and then, you know, just depending on, you know, what your blood sugar levels are, you know, you can definitely have some symptoms as far as your kind of clouded consciousness and or feeling just, you know, some weakness, and so a little bit more, you know, vague symptoms like that. Definitely if your blood sugar gets out of control, you know, that's when you, you know, as with all these things, you can get very symptomatic. But, you know, diabetes type 2 has actually become an epidemic in our society, and 1/4 of people over the age of 65 have it. Oh. So, I mean, to me, that's just outrageous. 25% of the population over the age of 65.
And again, so, this comes from our lifestyle.
Yeah, you know, it comes, everything that I talked about before, it's like not eating the right foods, not exercising, just staying up too late at night. You know, they found that people who stay up after midnight on a regular basis have almost twice the incidence of diabetes. So our bodies are actually designed to go to bed before 10 o'clock, and they found that we have all these hormonal fluctuations throughout the day and throughout the night. And if you go to bed before 10 o'clock, those hormonal fluctuations are optimal. If you go to bed after 10 o'clock, they're not.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not talking just about like estrogen and progesterone, testosterone, but also insulin. And the sleep hormone melatonin, which has many other effects on the body, and also a stress hormone, cortisol. So staying up past midnight on a regular basis can almost double your risk not only of diabetes but also of heart disease, obesity, and certain cancers like breast cancer and prostate cancer. So it's a simple thing to do is back the bedtime up a little earlier and get to bed before 10 o'clock and get up by 6 o'clock, and usually find you have a heck of a lot more energy if you do that, too.
Now, what about the risk factors? I mean, is there familial history of the diabetes in the family, running, does that
influence
environment?
A lot of times what we find is when we find things run it in families, it has more to do with the fact that everybody's eating the same way, everybody's exercising or not exercising the same way, what way you handle stress is the same. So that's much more, you know, of what we see. Now, we do find that there are sometimes nutrient depletions that can be contributing factors, and vitamin D is one of them. So there's just been tons of research that's been done on vitamin D in the last decade.
So
we now recognize it works more like a hormone in our body, and it's essential for every cell to function properly. And we manufacture vitamin D in our skin, but you have to be exposed to sunlight, you know, on a regular basis, and most people don't do that.
I would think where you live is going to determine that, too.
Sure.
You know, you may not have the option of
that.
Yeah,
Yeah. I mean, the northern climates, the winter time, I mean, there's no way you're going to get, you know, adequate amounts of sun. So the estimate is 80% of people in the United States are low on vitamin D. And so most experts say everyone should be taking a supplement of vitamin D3. And the amount that we used to recommend is way the heck too low. We used to say 400 international units a day, and now it's recognized that most people need at least 2,000 international units a day, and sometimes much more, you know, depending on their certain situation, because everybody metabolizes it differently. If you have any kind of chronic illness, sometimes your levels are really low, and you need to have, you know, take 5,000 or sometimes, you know, even more to get your levels up into that therapeutic range. But interestingly, what they found with in the relationship with your vitamin D levels and diabetes is that there's almost this linear type of relationship. So when you have low levels, your risk of diabetes is significantly increased. And there was a study that came out just a couple months ago that showed that as your levels go up, your risk of diabetes goes down, and it's not by a small amount. So if you get your levels up to that therapeutic range, which is considered, you know, kind of 50 to 60 nanograms per milliliter, then what they found was there could be up to an 80% reduction in your risk of diabetes.
Wow. Hey, 80%.
80%. By taking simple vitamin D. Now, the important thing with this is you got to get your levels checked. And you actually don't even need to go to a doctor's office for that. You can order a kit from a site on the Internet called NutrientPower.org. And that organization is a, you know, 501c3 organization that's doing a lot of research on the blood levels of vitamin D and its relationship to various different diseases. So you order this kit, comes to your house, and has instructions that basically you're pricking your finger, putting a little dot of blood on a piece of paper, sending it in, and then it'll let you know what your vitamin D levels are, and you can adjust how much you're taking accordingly. And the recommendation is to repeat that test every 6 months so you stay on top of it, because there's a lot of things that can vary, you know, how much vitamin D you need to take.
So I guess the treatment, a major component of the treatment, is, again, adapting, changing one's lifestyle, as far as what you're eating, your exercise, your sleeping, all of that contributes.
Right. I mean, we sound like a broken record.
I know. We do.
I mean, all these things truly do.
They
increase your risk. And one of the many, many reasons, we're giving you many reasons why you want to pay attention to your health, because it can lower your risk of all these different conditions. Yeah.
Well, I think this leads right directly into pancreatic cancer, because the pancreas in diabetes is very important. And with pancreatic cancer, you're talking about enzymes that aid in digestion and hormones that help us manage our blood sugar, right?
Yeah. Well, with pancreatic cancer, you know, it's actually cancer that forms in the pancreas. And they did find that having diabetes can increase your risk of developing it. Now, I'm also board certified in general surgery and used to operate on people with pancreatic cancer. And back when I was doing that, it was actually pretty darn uncommon. And we had no idea why people got it. We just thought it was a matter of bad luck.
Mm-hmm.
And so now what's happened is that incidence of pancreatic cancer is increasing like crazy. They're expecting it to go up by 50% in the next decade. And now we've identified all these diet and lifestyle factors that have strong contributions to it. So increasing age, men have a higher risk. Being black increases your risk. Smoking, being obese, eating, you know, high-fat, high-sugary diet, drinking alcohol, particularly if you've had multiple episodes of pancreatitis. And then, you know, type 2 diabetes is something that increases your risk as well. And then, interestingly, they found that drinking sugary, like colas and soda pops, you know, kind of thing, that there's a really strong link in this one study that they found that if you just drink two of these sugared drinks twice a week. That's it. Two a week. I mean, some people drink, you know, 12 a day.
12, that's right.
There's a
two a week.
Significant increased, yeah, there's a statistically significant increased risk of pancreatic cancer if you do that. So It's not a health drink.
No, no. Share with us exactly what role your pancreas plays. What does the pancreas do?
Well, the pancreas does, numerous, different things, but mm-hmm. it produces various different hormones. So, the beta cells produce the insulin. And as I, mentioned before when we were talking about diabetes, insulin is a hormone that helps to facilitate getting glucose into the cells. And then it also produces some other hormones that are involved in mostly regulation of your blood sugar. So that's kind mm-hmm. of the main function of it.
Well, I think when I think of pancreatic cancer, well, of course, the most recent death that we had that everybody was aware of was Aretha Franklin. That was pancreatic cancer. And Steve Jobs, wasn't that pancreatic?
Steve Jobs, that's right. Patrick Swayze.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. Now, there are different types of pancreatic cancer. I guess one is a lot more aggressive than the others because it seemed like Aretha, if I remember correctly, had she was diagnosed in 2010 and lasted to 2018, where there's some folks that seem like the diagnosis is followed by death pretty soon.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is. It's a cancer that's super aggressive, and it's very hard to diagnose.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
Again, no symptoms when you start out.
Here we go again.
The pancreas is super deep in your abdomen, so you can't feel it, mm-hmm. if you're trying to palpate through your abdomen. And they actually have found that there's no screening tests that are effective in reducing mortality from it, so nothing's recommended to screen it. And most times when people start to have symptoms with it, it's too late. Mm-hmm. And the 5-year survival is just really dismal. It's only 5%. So you really want to not get this in the first place. And, doing everything you can to keep yourself healthy that we've been talking about with diet and lifestyle is one of the key things that you can mm-hmm. do to lower your risk.
Well, I know my husband said when he was in medical school, and if pancreatic cancer came up, it was an issue, he had a professor that used to say, well, we need to tell this patient not to play any long-playing records because that's just what he said. That's the way he said they just used to, not in a joke, but just being very real, that,
right.
Hey, it's really a very, very serious condition and disease to get.
Yeah, it usually goes fast.
It goes
fast.
So
that's why your husband was saying that. But, if for some reason you do catch it earlier, mm-hmm. there is surgery that can be done. And, of course, they treat you with chemo, which isn't that incredibly effective, but, can extend your life a little bit. So sometimes it is. Can be cured with surgery, but again, you kind of have to find it before you have symptoms.
Mm-hmm. And I guess another problem with pancreatic cancer is that the way it's positioned, you'd see a lot of metastasis more so, right?
Well, it's just like I said,
you can't see.
Usually, you don't have any symptoms until it's too late.
So well, how is it diagnosed?
Already have metastasized.
Exactly how do they diagnose it? What is it, an endoscope? I mean, what do they use?
Usually a CAT scan is what is done. And so people can, once you have the tumor that starts to grow, it can obstruct the bile duct and cause you to have jaundice. And
people don't have much, they don't have any pain through all of this, huh? Or
well,
I guess by the time they get
but later they do. Yeah.
By the time they get the pain, it's too late.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so prevention is maintaining a healthy weight, I guess, choosing a healthy diet.
That's right.
Stop smoking, okay, being aware of just your lifestyle. So
I see
why you are identifying these conditions as, they can be very life-threatening, but if one is aware of them and is aware of their lifestyle and the ramifications of what they are doing or are not doing, that that can make a big difference. And that can really direct you as far as prevention is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Even if, you know, we move on to the HPV virus, which mm-hmm. is the most common sexually transmitted disease, and the danger with it is that it can lead to cervical cancer. They've actually found that diet and lifestyle plays a role in that one, too. So HPV, as I said, is the most common sexually transmitted disease, and the estimates is that of all the people that are sexually active, about 70% of those individuals will come in contact with the HPV virus. Now, the good news is that if you have a healthy diet and lifestyle, mm-hmm. then you're going to have a healthy immune system.
Okay.
And so in healthy people, they found that this virus will clear in 98% of those people on its own. I mean, so it just goes away. You know,
right.
Basically.
Yeah. That, and that's just what I was going to ask you, because I was going to say, since it is a virus, don't you just kind of let it run its course? I mean, because there's no real treatment for it, right?
Yeah, well, there is no Western treatment for
right.
it.
Right.
Yeah, so like antivirals, you know, don't
mm-hmm,
work.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't give you any antibiotics that work for viruses. So there's no Western treatment that's effective. If you, the main concern is that, like in women, if they get a chronic HPV infection, it shows up on their cervix, and you can see evidence of it from pap smears, so that's kind of how we monitor it. And then if there's some changes to the cells there, then the OBGYNs generally are the ones that do this, where they'll treat it topically and even sometimes have to do surgical excisions of it. So none of that sounds really fun.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Team, and I am talking with Dr. Christine Horner, MD. Dr. Horner is credited with launching a 5-year crusade called the Breast Reconstruction Advocacy Project that led to the passage of an unprecedented federal law that was signed by President Bill Clinton in 1998, requiring insurance companies to pay for breast reconstruction following mastectomy. Dr. Horner joins me, and I had to interrupt you. We were talking about HPV, so will you continue?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, so the HPV infection, as we were, you know, discussing with it, it's a virus, and so there's actually no antivirals mm-hmm. or antibiotics or anything like that that is effective at getting rid of it. And so there's some really exciting research that actually is just coming out of the University of Texas Health Sciences, where the researcher decided to test a mushroom formula mm-hmm. out of Japan called AHCC. And
okay.
AHCC has actually been around for decades, and they discovered it that it's really the most effective formula, mushroom formula. They found it helping to support your immune system, and they actually even prescribe it in the hospitals in Japan, mostly for cancer patients, because mm-hmm. they found that it really helps with the side effects of chemotherapy and keeping your immune system strong, and that there's significant improved survival statistics taking it. But this researcher thought, okay, let me test it against the HPV virus, because it was shown to also have some antiviral properties. And so what she discovered was that it actually killed the HPV virus. And then she did a clinical trial on women who had the chronic HPV infection, again, no effective Western treatment, and she found that those women who took AHCC for 6 months or longer, that it completely eradicated that virus. And they've done follow-up studies on it. Yeah, they did follow-up studies, and they found that it stayed away, so it's not like it went into some
remission
phase.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now they're doing a much bigger clinical trial now to substantiate the statistics that they got. But super exciting, I think, mm-hmm. that we actually have something that doesn't have any horrible side effects, just side right. benefits, that is effective in getting rid of this HPV virus.
Would you distinguish HPV with HIV and, what is it, HSV?
Sounds like an alphabet.
That's an it. I know. I thought we've been saying all these acronyms, so let's say completely what
right.
they, okay.
Yeah, so HPV stands for human papillomavirus.
Okay.
And there's actually about 100 different strains, maybe mm-hmm. more of these viruses, and just a couple of them are, you know, ones that are the most common ones. About 40 of them, I think, they say can contribute to some disease, and other ones don't have any, you know, terrible diseases associated with them. So human papillomavirus, yeah. Then HIV is mm-hmm. Another virus, but that's the one that we're all familiar with that creates AIDS. And it's a human immunodeficiency virus that really knocks out your immune system, and the consequences of that are really catastrophic. Now we've got a lot of drugs that are available that are allowing these people to live, you know, pretty mm-hmm. much normal lives, you know, now, compared to how it was before, where it was really a death sentence.
Yeah, it was. If people didn't know, I know I was working in the hospital at that time when it was just, you know, really becoming more prevalent. And you look back and you think about the way we addressed it. I know there's a physician, psychiatrist, who wiped off everything with alcohol. He kept alcohol swabs in his pocket, you know. And you know, we just thought that that might be the way to go.
Well, I know it. We must have been in residency at the same time, because it was like we had our first AIDS patient when I was in residency, and nobody knew what it was.
Mm-mm.
And we were all Mm-mm. freaking out, and he was in, like, you know, quarantined, and so.
Yeah,
anyway,
so we've come a long way.
We have.
What about the vaccine for HPV? And I know it's been pretty controversial. People didn't want to get it, but would you share what's
sure.
happening with the vaccine?
Sure. Well, you know, I think that there's a definitely a good place for vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And, some of it, you know, I think it's important to have common sense, you know, mm-hmm. too, where, you know, if we have a disease that's affecting a significant number of people and causing deaths, it's, you know,
yep.
you definitely want to use a vaccine for that.
And particularly young people. I mean, I had to throw that in there.
Sure.
Young folks.
Yeah.
Young folks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you, they want to vaccinate people that are 11 or 12 years old, because once you're mm-hmm. sexually active mm-hmm. and you've been exposed to the HPV virus, you can't have the vaccine, because mm-hmm. that vaccine will actually make your situation worse.
Right.
And increase your risk of getting lesions. So, you know, there's just so much controversy with it for many reasons. And one is, as I mentioned, your own body's immune system will fight this virus off 98% of the time. So you only have 2% of people that are going on to get chronic infections. And now we've got a mushroom formula that treats that. So it's kind of almost like it's not that much of an issue. So
mm-hmm.
vaccinating like crazy for something that isn't that much of an issue, does that make sense? And then you have to look at the, you know, the side effects, potential side effects of the vaccine. And this is the vaccine that's had the most reported adverse reactions for any other vaccine. And these are minor adverse reactions. I mean, they've had people that have developed permanent neurological problems and even death. And it's like, okay, do I want my daughter to die, potentially die,
right.
over a disease that, you know, likelihood of her getting it is like only a 2% chance, and then it's completely treatable with a mushroom formula.
But not just daughters.
Just doesn't make sense.
Excuse me for interrupting, but not just daughters, but sons too.
Right.
Sons too.
That's
so
true.
This is a vaccine that's for both male and female.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's a good point.
Yeah, so anyway, to me, it doesn't make sense.
mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't want to expose my child to that one. You know, if you eat a healthy diet and lifestyle, you're completely fine, or you can take the mushroom formula, you know, too. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. As time is moving on, let's look at sleep apnea, and I want to get to your book, you know?
Sure.
But sleep apnea, what is happening? What is going on when someone has sleep apnea? I mean, basically what you say, tell us.
Yeah. Well, sleep apnea, we think of it as a fat snoring man's disease. Mm-hmm. Which they definitely have an increased risk of it. But what sleep apnea is not snoring. It's actually you stop breathing for several seconds during the night. And 90% of people who have it don't know that they have it because, you know, you're asleep. So
right.
If you have someone in bed with you who's listening to you, and they can tell you, hey, you know, sounds like you stopped, you know, breathing and the middle of the night, then what you need to do actually is to go to a sleep lab where they hook you up to all sorts of monitors and monitor you overnight, and then they can determine whether you have sleep apnea, and if you do, then how severe it is, and that would determine, you know, what your treatments will be. So if it's a little bit more severe, they'll treat you with this, it's called a CPAP mask, a continuous positive airway pressure a machine where you wear a mask at night that forces, you know, your airways open. The reason you don't want sleep apnea is because it will increase your risk of all the other things we were talking about before. So it actually increases your risk of high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes, and kidney disease.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping your head elevated, most people are overweight. Again, diet and lifestyle, eating junk foods, eating heavy meals too late at night, drinking alcohol excessively in the evenings, taking sedatives or sleeping pills, all those things are things that can contribute. So reversing all that with an excellent diet and exercise and the rest of your lifestyle can certainly improve your situation. And in the meantime, there's, you know, the remedies that they have from using that, you know, mask to even having kind of prosthesis kind of thing that you put in your mouth. It keeps your jaw from closing down. And
do all of those things work? You see some advertised even on television, you know, do this for sleep apnea. And I guess it's on an individual basis. But how efficient are they, those different apparatus?
You know, they are. So like I said, it's important that you get diagnosed properly, which requires going to the sleep lab. And then depending on how severe your condition is and what the reason is for your condition, then they would prescribe to you the appropriate, measures, which could include some of those machines or contraptions, you know, basically.
And there are a couple of symptoms that one may have, and I mean, these symptoms could apply to a number of things, but I think it might be helpful to share with a listening audience. For example, if you find that person, if you're waking up with a dry mouth all the time, or if you wake up with a headache, I know headaches are very much associated with sleep apnea. Okay.
Yeah, particularly for women. So sometimes women don't snore. You know, the men are the big snorers,
right.
And sometimes women can have sleep apnea and not be snoring, and so they'll have more vague symptoms like the, you know, headaches or daytime sleepiness, is a big one, you know, too, because you're not sleeping very well. Yeah.
And if you're that mate and you hear throughout the night your partner kind of gasping, choking, gasping, that may also be an indicator that you know, something is going on. Would you agree?
Yes. Absolutely. And then they're ruining your sleep.
Yes, that's right. That's right. You know, and anybody can have it. Before we move on and talk about your book, but I want the listening audience to know that this is not something that you just see in adults. You may see it more so in adults. But children can have sleep apnea, okay? And so they need to be aware of that. Hello? You still there? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that covers those five, you know, threatening life, potentially life-threatening conditions that we need to be aware of as adults, parents, teachers, and whomever need to be aware of these illnesses. And now we can get to, I know you have written a couple books, but Dr. Horner has a new book out that she, it's just out, right? Just come out?
It came out about just a little bit over a year ago.
About a year ago, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's called Radiant Health, Ageless Beauty.
Okay.
And it's a guide about how to create extraordinary health and longevity. So when I was in med school and residencies, I can truly say with accuracy, I learned nothing about health.
Mm-hmm.
I learned about diseases and how to suppress symptoms, you know, using surgery and medications, but I didn't really learn how do you create health. And it wasn't until I actually studied Ayurveda, you know, the system of medicine from India, which the whole focus is about how do you create health. And so instead of this being a book about how to prevent disease, it's a book about how to create health. And when you create health, obviously you're preventing all those different diseases too. But it's meant to be a guidebook, and it goes through all the different diets and lifestyles and supplements and emotions that play, you know, a huge role and so forth, so that it can help you to achieve the highest state of health possible and enjoy a really long life.
Well, where can one get your book? Where is it?
Well, my book actually won a National Book Award for the best book in health, medicine, and nutrition, so it's available everywhere. You can get it on Amazon.com, of course, Barnes & Noble's, and if you want an autographed copy, you can get it from my website, which is drchristinehorner.com, drchristinehorner.com.
Okay. Would you share in these last couple of minutes any of the life-affirming tips that you offer for adults and their bodies?
You know, for sure. Besides, you know, the things that we've been talking about, which I think most people would know, you know, anyway, it's kind of common sense, you know, as far as, you know, eat more plants and eat less hot dogs. And, you know, exercise and get some sunshine, the vitamin D and so forth. But one of the things that people aren't aware of is that of all the things that affect our bodies, more than diet, more than lifestyle, and more than smoking, is our emotions, and in particular, the emotion of feeling loved and supported. Mm-hmm. So they found of, you know, all the things, like I said, the one thing that affects us as human beings, our longevity and the quality of our life and survival from diseases, it's all about you feeling like you're loved and supported. It's like the most critical thing. So I work a lot with breast cancer patients. That was one of my specialties. My first book is on all the natural approaches to protecting against and fighting breast cancer. But when I go through coaching, you know, with them, it's like, well, you know, a lot of times we get people in our lives that are not very supportive of us, and we kind of call these toxic relationships, and it turns out that it's the most stressful emotion on the human body. And so it gives you a different perspective of the people that you have in your life. And I'm like, okay, so we have 7 billion people on the planet. We have a lot of choices. And you just want to make sure that everybody that you have in your life is loving and supportive. If you feel worse being with that person or if they're putting you down, don't have them in your life.
Right. But, you know, for many people, we can laugh about it, but it's easier said than done. You know, you think about those people who are in very stressful relationships, but it's not that easy for them to walk away for whatever, you know, whatever the dynamics may be. They find it very difficult to sever that relationship, even though they know it is a toxic relationship.
Uh-huh.
So that's something, you know, we have to take into consideration. And I think before we close, I think it's so important that we emphasize that exercise really is pretty much a panacea.
Well, that and good sleep.
And sleep.
I mean, there's so many things. I mean, it's not like it's just one thing.
But no,
yes,
it's not.
Exercise, you know, helps to counteract a lot of, you know, damage. And
right.
we used to think it was just for cardiovascular system,
uh-huh.
but now we understand
it's not.
That when you exercise, there's all sorts of proteins and hormones that are released that, you know, help to affect how your genes are expressed
right.
and reduces your risk of cancers and increases longevity and all sorts of great things.
Dr. Horner, thanks so much. I mean, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and the information that you have shared is just invaluable. To my listening audience, thank you for your time and your ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.